most of our decisions come from the reptilian part of our brain, which is the least evolved part. It's the oldest part of the brain. It's the thing that pretty much anything with a brain has, and it's motivated by greed and lust and the desire to reproduce and the, you know, fear of being a social outcast. So we make all of the vast majority of our decisions in the exact same way that all of these primal animals do.
Hey everyone, today we're talking with Dan Monheit, co-founder of Hardhat, a creative agency, and also co-host of the Bad Decisions podcast. Dan knows so much about how we actually make decisions, how we buy things. Dan really understands the power of heuristics and how we can apply that to branding, marketing, and strategy. So buckle up and let's talk branding. This episode is sponsored by Holabrief. Holabrief is the go-to platform for creative briefings. It helps you to get a deeper understanding of the project. It helps you to reduce feedback and become a more valuable partner to your client. For more information, visit holabrief.com/LTB. Hey everyone, today we're talking with Dan Monheit. Dan, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. So I'm the, I guess, co-founder of a creative agency in Melbourne, Australia called Hardhat. This is still technically my first job. We've been doing this for about 15 years now. And we're a fully independent sort of 40-person agency working with a really interesting mix of clients.
Awesome. Like, how did you end up founding this agency? Because there's a lot of options when going into this space, of course.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of options about getting good jobs, which is definitely one path that people can go down. My business partner and I, you know, we've been friends since we were 10 years old. And when we were around about 24, we were both pretty much straight out of university. He had graduated, you know, he'd studied creative advertising, and it's really, really hard to break into the industry. I'd studied marketing and had got my first job, but absolutely hated it. And so, you know, the two of us just kind of decided that we would just have a crack at trying to start an agency, neither of us ever having worked at one before, which seemed like a brilliant idea at the time.
It wasn't a bad decision, was it?
Well, so, you know, I wonder, how much time we would have saved and how many lessons we would have learned if we'd maybe just spent a year or two working somewhere instead of literally having, like, we literally knew not a single thing when we started. But, you know, we picked up a lot of valuable lessons. And I think it's always tricky if you do start working somewhere. We tend to scale up our lifestyles with, you know, our jobs and our pay packets. And I think it becomes increasingly difficult to start for yourself the further down that road you get.
Yeah, it's so funny. Me and my brother started the agency like straight out of school as well. And I recognize that feeling that, like, if only we knew a little bit more, like, what's all of those stupid things that we could have, like, but you're right. I mean, it's just a risk you took. And then in the end, like, I don't think you regret it, right?
No, of course not. But it is funny. I mean, I think maybe 4 years in, we hired our first sort of, you know, account service people who'd actually worked in other places before. And they're like, so this is a contact report. Like, this is what you write at the end of a meeting that captures what everybody said and didn't agree. It's like, wow, this is a brilliant document. We should have these from the start instead of just trying to remember everything. But yeah, you know, what you miss out on there, you sort of make up in hustle and just working out how to get things done.
Awesome. Like, Hardhat, could you explain us a bit how it looks like, what type of clients, what type of work?
Absolutely. So we spent the first, let's call it 12 years becoming what is known as, and I'm doing air quotes for people, a digital agency, right? So if we go right back to the start, the ambition for Justin, my business partner, and I was to become a great sort of branding creative agency. What we found out very quickly was that nobody wanted branding advice from two 24-year-old guys with no experience. But in 2005, what people were very happy to take our advice on and to pay us money to do was to make internet stuff for them. Right, so 2005, this is like pre-Facebook, pre-YouTube. Google was one of a handful of search engines you might have decided to use on any given day. So people would say to us, look, please don't touch my branding. But hey, if you could make me a website or you could do my email marketing, like, that would be great. Can you guys do that stuff? I said, yeah, of course we can do that stuff. So, you know, we took our first three or four deposits, found some kids at, you know, universities that could actually make this stuff and set about becoming a digital agency. And over the first 12 or so years of our business, that meant lots of different things as the technology changed and the market changed. And so we went from doing lots of websites and EDMs to things like web apps or flash apps and games and mobile apps and social media and all of the different things you had to do over the years to be a digital agency. And about 2 years ago, we sort of looked at the future for digital agencies in at least our part of the world. And most of them ended up becoming very big technology businesses where, you know, you basically end up being 80% engineers doing these big kind of technical projects with a very thin veneer of brand or creative or design over the top. Mm-hmm. And we decided that that's not our path. We never got into this for the tech. The tech was just our way to be credible. And really what we set about doing as of really 2 years ago was to try and pivot that deep digital heritage into being a modern creative agency. And so we have added, you know, almost another 50% to the business. You know, we've kept that digital core, but we've brought in some really talented people who come from more of the old world of advertising and to complement all of those technical skills with big brand thinking and proper brand strategy and those sorts of things.
You've balanced the internet stuff with the brand stuff, right?
Well, that's been the vision. I think, you know, a lot of big traditional agencies have been trying to go the other way. You know, the agencies with a deep heritage in making TV commercials and outdoor advertising, trying to get good at internet stuff. And we've gone the other way. And, you know, my view is learning new stuff is always going to be hard, but the stuff that we need to learn, I think, is easier than what they need to learn. Like what we learned, we didn't realize it at the time, it was like altitude training. You know, we were working with the smallest budgets on the most fickle audiences with the highest transparency over what we were doing. And we get to kind of stretch out now with longer timelines and bigger budgets and harder reporting metrics. I think it's much easier to do that than to try and go the other way. You know, if you're used to building something for $1 million to work out how to do it for 10,000 is much harder than if you're used to doing it for 10,000 and somebody gives you $1 million.
Absolutely. Well, I got to know you through the, well, first of the Let's Talk Marketing podcast, but then of course I learned about the Bad Decisions podcast, which I highly recommend to anyone listening. But like, how did you come up with this idea for the Bad Decisions podcast? What was the driver behind starting that?
Cool. First of all, thank you for the plug. It's funny, you know how it is. You make a podcast and you go and look at the stats and you sort of forget that these little numbers are actual people. And you're like, oh, like somebody in Belgium listened to my podcast. Like, that's cool, you know. But then when they actually email you and say, hey, I listened to your podcast, come and talk to me. It's a really funny thing. So thank you for the plug. For people that haven't heard of the podcast, The show is myself and a psychologist, her name's Dr. Melissa Weinberg, sitting down for, you know, 20 or 25 minutes to talk about a heuristic. And a heuristic is a thing like within the world of – sorry, maybe I need to go back half a step. There's a world of behavioral economics, which is basically a field of study that looks at why we make decisions that often don't really make sense. You know, so why do we overeat? Why do we spend more money than we should? Why do we stay up late when we know we need to be up the next morning? Why do we go out with our loved ones and sit there checking our phones the whole time? Like, why do we do things that even at the time of doing them, we know are terrible things to be doing? And so there's a field of study called behavioral economics that explores that. And within the world of behavioral economics, there are somewhere between a few dozen and a couple of hundred of these things called heuristics, which are these consistent quirks in human behavior or human thinking, which cause us to make these suboptimal or bad decisions. And they really do sit at the intersection of marketing and psychology. And I'm a marketing ad guy. Dr. Mel Weinberg is a psychologist. And so each episode, we pick one of these heuristics and we talk about where it came from and why it works. Mel talks a lot about the research and the neuroscience. I talk about, as marketers and brand people, how do we use that to sell more stuff?
Mm-hmm. Did you just like wake up one morning and say, I'm going to do a podcast about heuristics? Like what was the motivation behind that?
So I think the things that guide the hand on the shelf have always intrigued me. I've always been curious about what is it that makes people choose one thing over another. Where objectively, most stuff is pretty similar, right? But for some reason, people make decisions in certain ways. So it's always been something that I've been curious about, something that I've always read about. And you just sort of follow your curiosity. And probably the book that really struck it for me, the first one I read on this, was a book called Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely, who's sort of one of the godfathers of behavioral economics. And so that got me interested in it. And then Mel and I sort of know each other. We've sort of got some mutual friends. We used to play basketball in the same club. And she's very, very academic in her world, and I'm very, very commercial in my world. And we've just sort of found this. We found when we were hanging out this really interesting little overlap of things we were both really interested in. Because Mel's normal job, you know, as a psychologist, she works with elite sports people. She works a lot in the field of subjective well-being. So like, what makes us happy and why are we so bad at predicting what is going to make ourselves happy? And she works with she does psycho-oncology, so working with cancer patients and their families. But so very different worlds, but we have this kind of overlapping slice about what makes people happy. And we started, and sorry, she looks at that from a psychological perspective. I think about it from a brand perspective. Like, most brands are trying to get people to buy something that's going to make them happier than before they had it. And so we just would find ourselves talking about this stuff. And we found it interesting. We thought, well, maybe if we just sort of dropped the microphone in the middle while we were talking about these things, other people would find it interesting as well. And maybe 2 years ago, we just started recording episodes and really enjoyed it. And it seems that lots of other people around the world have enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's funny, the dynamic you guys have is really interesting, just maybe because of like the whole idea of the scientist and then the marketer sitting together. That's really like, it makes you laugh, but it's also something that's quite interesting. And I think it is something real that people from our industry that are interested in science have this like this funny overlap where sometimes it gets a bit unethical, especially when unethical, you know, when you're talking about like behavioral and psychology, it almost gets into like manipulating people. And that's something that you and her talk about a lot on the podcast. And that's really interesting to me, like that balance between when are you actually like trying to manipulate people and when it's just about like, yeah, that's a really, did you feel similar about that?
Yeah. So the thing about, you know, being a strategy person in an agency is I think we all have this fear when we're presenting and things to clients that like we're fake psychologists, right? Like strategy people in agencies, we talk about how people think and how people feel, but we know that's not really our thing. So being kind of in the booth with Mel, or sometimes I bring her to presentations and things as well. She does a bit of freelance work with the agency, lets me cover that vulnerability. Like she can purely focus on the science and the academia and the research. And that really frees me up to just lean into being the ad guy hard, which I quite enjoy. And so we sort of get to become extreme versions of ourselves. But from in terms of manipulating people, I mean, I think the word manipulating has a very negative context. And the reality is all of us, like every piece of comms, everything we do is trying to manipulate people. It's trying to get people to choose one thing over another, to think one way over another. And when you realize that you can't not do that, right? So it's not, are we going to try and shape people's actions or not, right? Whatever you do is shaping people's actions. Then the question is, okay, well then should we do that in an informed way or an uninformed way?
I agree.
There's another great book on behavioral economics called Nudge. I think it's called Nudge by Richard Thaler. And I think in the opening chapter, he talks about a lady who's responsible for setting out the food in a school cafeteria. So you imagine like in American TV shows, you know, the kids go to the cafeteria for lunch and there's all those trays of food. And she wonders to herself, I wonder if the order with which I set up the food will impact the amount of each type of food that kids have, like if I put the healthy food first or the healthy food last, or, you know, and she does some experiments and she finds that, yes, she can manipulate what food is taken in what quantity. And so then when you realize that you can do that, then you have to work out, well, God, what am I going to do with this power now? And I think it's Absolutely. The same for us in advertising and comms. Like, we know we can shape people's behavior. We can either be good at it or bad at it, and we can be moral or immoral, but we can't not do it. If we don't do it, we're not doing our jobs.
Yeah. And what's really fascinating to me is like a lot of people in marketing and strategy and advertising and so on, they tend to like dismiss this idea of people buying like just on based on automatic decisions or like system one thinking, or there's some ways to describe it. You're using mm-hmm. heuristics to make decisions, basically not really thinking rationally about it, but just doing stuff. They tend to like say, well, that's not true. I mean, people think about the purpose of the brand and the whole story behind it. And there's this whole like idea of brands needing to have a really strong message, while heuristics is really showing that a lot of decisions are made just like automatically. Like, why do you think that a lot of marketers like try to dismiss that idea that we're just irrational buyers?
So, as humans, we're not very good at knowing why we do things at all. And we would all like to think that we are very, very rational operators. And in fact, the whole field of behavioral economics came up because we have a school of thinking called economics, which says we're all very rational people. And the more something costs, the less people are going to want to buy it. And every time we need to make a decision, we look at all of the different options. We decide what is going to have the best long-term impact, you know, for the short-term cost, and we pick accordingly. So there's a school of thinking that says that. And what we realize is that is usually not the way we make decisions. We usually don't make the best decisions in our long-term interest. So there's a part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex. So I'm trying not to get too deep down a rabbit hole here. The part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex, which from the evolutionary perspective is the newest part of the brain, and it's a part of the brain that only really humans have. And the prefrontal cortex is where we do all of this very rational, objective, strategic thinking. And we have decided historically that because humans are the only creature that has that part of the brain, that must be how we make all of our decisions. But what we realize is actually most of our decisions come from the reptilian part of our brain, which is the least evolved part. It's the oldest part of the brain. It's the thing that pretty much anything with a brain has, and it's motivated by greed and lust and the desire to reproduce and the, you know, fear of being a social outcast. So we make all of the vast majority of our decisions in the exact same way that all of these primal animals do. The problem is we have the prefrontal cortex / PR department at the front that makes up these wonderful stories about why we did things, you know, that yes, it did make a lot of sense to buy that, you know, two-door sports car, even though you have two young children, because it is very, very well made and it's going to be a family heirloom and the fuel efficiency is really good. So that was a very good rational choice. And rational choices are what wins most arguments. It's what wins in most boardrooms. It's very hard to graph non-rational behavior in Excel. So I think our whole culture is driven by the desire to explain things rationally and with algorithms and with logic and with data, even if we can see that that's really not how most of our decisions are made.
Well, actually, like I think my wife by now, she hates the fact that I listen to your podcast, because like all of the things we're trying to decide now, I'm like post-analyzing myself, like, am I doing this based on one heuristic or is it rational thinking? And it's so funny how once you understand a lot of these heuristics, you really start to like think about all the decisions you make. So it's becoming quite interesting.
Yeah, it's funny, people ask me, oh, because you look into this so much and do the podcast, you get better at making decisions. And I think I don't, but I just get better at realizing how and why I've made stupid decisions in the past. You know, you see it retrospectively. I'm just wondering, for people that for whom this is all completely new territory, like, is it worth diving into a couple of the heuristics, or are there any in particular that you're interested in asking
Absolutely,
about or talking about?
I think you knew what was coming, so somehow you have like a glass ball. No, next question was going to be, what's one of your like favorite heuristics, or what was a heuristic that really like stuck by, that's like something that really struck you?
Cool. So So as we said, so heuristics are these consistent quirks that cause us to make objectively strange choices. So there are lots of them. I love lots of them. One that jumps out, and the reason I like talking about this one is because I think it's quite a useful one, is there's a heuristic called the peak end rule. And the peak end rule looks at the way we remember experiences. And so if we were to take the objective, rational, economist view of how we remember an experience, right? So let's imagine going to a conference. So you decide to take a day off work and go to a conference, right? And somebody says to you at work the next day, hey, how was the conference yesterday? The objective, rational, economist way of thinking about that would be you would consider how you felt in every session, or maybe every hour, or maybe every 15 minutes, or maybe every minute, you know, out of 10, how was I feeling throughout the day? And then you would give an average score of how the conference was based on that. And what some really interesting research by Danny Kahneman showed us is that not all parts of an experience are equal contributors to how we remember it. And by far, our memories are far more shaped by the peak experiences, so the emotional high points or low points, and the ending. So if we were to take that conference example, when somebody says to you, how was the conference yesterday, you are far more likely to think of the best or the worst bit and how you felt at the end of the day when it was sort of all said and done, and that's what's going to drive your answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that.
So the reason I think this is interesting is because it gives marketers a really good steer on what things to focus on and what things not to focus on. So one of the things that we like to think about is that we need to create a wonderful end-to-end experience for our customers. You know, if a brand is the sum total of all of the touch points that somebody has with it, we need to make sure every one of those touch points is at least an 8 or 9 out of 10. And what the peak end rule tells us is that trying to make every single brand touch point an 8 or a 9 out of 10 is a wonderful ambition, right? But it's kind of misguided, because you would have far more success trying to pick one or two of those touch points and working out how to make that a 15 out of 10 experience, knowing that that is going to have a far bigger impact on the way people remember the experience they had with your brand than if everything was just pretty good across the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so give something away at the end, and that will probably have more impact than just trying to be good all over the whole experience.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you think about how wrong we usually get this, like if you think about hospitality experiences where you check into a hotel and there's usually a big song and dance in welcome drinks, and you sit down with the manager and they'll take you to your room and they'll show you around, and there's a lot of investment in the start of the experience. Mm-hmm. When you leave, often you're calling downstairs, waiting for somebody to come up and get your bags. You're checked out in a hurry. Like, you know, there is champagne on arrival. There should probably be champagne on departure, because that is far more likely to be impactful in how you think back on your experience.
Yeah. And I think even maybe if you would experiment with the idea of like where to actually, if you only have a limited amount of resources, where to give the champagne, it would probably have more impact if you only do it at the end.
Yeah. Or you do it on their last night there, saying, you know, we hope you've had a wonderful stay with us. It's like, that's the thing people are going to remember. There's a very fancy restaurant here in Melbourne called Vue du Monde. And it's one of those restaurants where you go there, you have a 15-course degustation, wine-matched meal. I've never been, but I've heard, right? It's a bit too fancy for me, but very sort of opulent, indulgent experience. And you imagine what happens at the end of a meal like this. Like the ending of this experience is usually you finished your meal and then you ask for the bill, right? And then that's kind of the last thing that you remember. You get the bill and you realize, I'm going to have to sell my car to pay for this dinner. And what Vue du Monde do, which is, you know, a masterstroke of peak end rule, is after they bring you the bill on your way out, they give you a little bag, and inside the bag are a couple of brioche rolls, some free range eggs, and a little card with instructions on it for how to make perfect scrambled eggs for breakfast the next morning. Right. So this has probably cost them $4 out of a, you know, $1,000 a head meal. But they've almost, you know, cleansed the palate. Like, you got the bill and now that's done. And then on your way out, you get this little gift bag with bread and eggs, and that is now the last experience you've had there, and that is what you remember, and it's unexpected and it's powerful, and it shapes. It's a thing people talk about after going to this restaurant. They talk about the $4 gift bag, not the $1,500 meal.
Hey there, I just wanted to let you know that if you are interested in doing strategic exercises together with your client, you can visit holabrief.com/LTB and use the code LTB to get a 20% discount. Now back to the podcast. Absolutely, I really love that. It also reminds me of like just not only like in advertising and creating experiences, but even how we as like agencies handle our clients. Like a lot of times I remember when I first started out, like we were so excited at the beginning of a project, but at the end we kind of like, yeah, next project please. But really, like if you think about it, like how clients perceive you, that's such a like, maybe go have dinner with your clients at the end of a project. Yeah, that will really increase your ratings, I think.
Yeah, because you're absolutely right. Everybody's so exhausted by the end of a project, everyone just kind of falls over the finish line in a heap together. One of the things we've done for a long time as an agency is at the end of a big project, especially like a big complicated website project where you know there's going to be ups and downs over the 6 to 12 months that you're working on it, is at the end on launch day, we send clients this thing we have in Australia called a smash cake, which it's basically like a cake made out of chocolate on the out, like a chocolate shell. And then on the inside, there's all candy inside. And it comes with a hammer. And so we sort of send this thing to the client's offer. And it's like, congratulations, you know, we smashed it together, whatever it is. And they get this hammer and they smash the cake and all the lollies come out everywhere. And you know, people from all over the office are walking over to go and see what this thing was. And that's now the last experience that they had on that project, as opposed to a completion invoice.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so peak end, I think really interesting and as you said, like actionable heuristic to work on. Let's pick another one.
Have you got a favorite, or you want me to just pick something else?
I'd love to talk about the exposure effect.
The mere exposure effect?
Mere exposure effect, yeah.
Cool. So I mean, this is a nice one because this just kind of means that advertising works. And you have to forgive me, I don't have the exact data from the study handy, but in the episode we talk a lot about the seminal study on this, which is kind of hilarious. So the idea of the mere exposure effect is that just by exposing people to a stimulus repeatedly makes them more open to it, and eventually they like it more. And this is an experience that you might have like in your own news feed, where you'll see a news article get suggested a few times. And the first time you see it, it kind of catches your attention, but you don't click on it. The second time you see it, you think, oh God, that's that article again. Maybe I should think about it. The third time you see it, you go, okay, I'm going to go and actually have a look. Like, you become more open to it. The seminal study on this was involved a teacher bringing a student into a classroom, and the student was basically completely enveloped in a black bag, just with his feet poking out the bottom. This is just a bizarre study. This was in the 70s sometime. And so the professor just brought this guy into every lecture that he did, or every class that he did. And he basically tracked how people felt about this random guy in a complete black sack sitting in the corner. And over the course of the semester, this went from scary and weird to kind of okay to almost like, this guy's like a mascot for our class and we kind of like him. And he didn't do anything. He just sat there, just a guy in a black bag with shoes poking out the bottom. And so, you know, if a black bag with shoes poking out the bottom can become more likable in a matter of weeks, you know, getting our clients' messaging out in front of people often in the right environment has got to be a good thing as well.
Absolutely. And what I really like... what really struck me with this effect was, I don't know if you've read How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp.
Yep.
Yeah, well, the whole science behind that is actually similar to this effect. I mean, it's just the idea of you need to have as much mental and physical availability. And I think just the mere exposure, like being out there on different channels as much as possible on the long term is probably more important than what you're saying. So I think that's something we really underestimate, because a lot of people believe that if you differentiate yourself enough, like people will come. But I think this idea of just like the mere exposure is such a like fundamental part of marketing.
Yeah. And I think what Byron Sharp talks about a lot is the idea of distinctiveness versus differentiation. So you don't necessarily have to be different to everybody else. You have to be distinct. And the idea with the mirror exposure effect is that it doesn't work if people don't know what they've been exposed to. So they need to know every time they see a piece of comms from your brand that it is from your brand. I don't know what Coke cans look like in Belgium at the moment, but in Australia in the last, I'm going to say 12 months, they've completely changed the way Coke and Diet Coke and Coke Zero work, where they used to all have their own cans, and the cans were all completely different. So Coke Zero was black, Diet Coke was silver, Coke was red. And now they're all red, except for a really thin strip around the top, which is either red or black or silver to denote which variant of Coke it is. And so the amount of exposure you get now to the Coke branding, because it's all consistent, is three times more than when they were trying to build three separate brands.
Yeah, absolutely. It also reminds me of this rebrand for Tropicana, where they lost millions in sales because they changed their packaging. And I think this is very much related to this effect where people are just like used to seeing it. And the more they used to seeing it, the easier they buy it. And I think that's something when we're thinking about like just the fact like how much to invest in media and advertising, I think this is a crucial factor, and that's proven by Byron Sharp. So a really interesting effect. Maybe one more effect that I really loved was the halo effect.
Cool. Can I say absolutely talk halo? I just feel like it would be remiss of me to not jump in with the availability bias.
Because it's related.
And the reason I want to jump in with that is because when we talk about things like the mirror exposure effect and the thinking of the guys like Byron Sharp and the research from those guys, it absolutely says media is hugely important, and it kind of doesn't matter what you say or how your brand looks. What is important is that people see it over and over and over again. And in a really extreme sense, that could almost say that we're all just wasting our time. Like, why even make an ad? Like, literally just put the logo in the middle of a box and just put it everywhere, like zero money on creative and production, 100% of budget in media. And what I like about behavioral economics is that it gives us cheat codes, right? So segue into the availability bias. The purpose of doing mirror exposure or putting a message everywhere is to try and get remembered and thought of. And we get ways to kind of hack that. The availability bias is the idea that the more available a thought is in our mind, the more likely we are to think that thing occurs. So things like shark attacks, like in Australia, you are significantly more likely to die drowning in a pool in somebody's home than you are being killed by a shark in the ocean. I think it's 22 times more likely to drown in a pool in someone's home. But when we think about risks and ways that we can die, we don't think very much about drowning. We think a lot about shark attacks, because when we ask our brain what are the ways people can die in water, right, shark attacks seem to be more available a memory, you know, an easy to access thought. It kind of jumps to the front of the queue over drowning, right? So the more available a memory is, the more likely we are to think something like that can happen. And there are things that make memories more available, more easily recalled. And those things are when things are highly emotional, when things are more creative, when things make us laugh or cry. And that is sort of where us as creative professionals get to inject our magic and say, well, even if we had a little bit less media budget and we're going to be in a fewer places, if our ad is easier to remember, more available, people will think about it more often. And I guess that's where we get to add in our magic.
Yeah, and I think it's really important what you said about this thought. Maybe if it's just a logo, then it's not really like you need to build some memory structures that like give context to buyer brand. So I think that's where creative does play a huge important role, that it's not just like if you just have one link and that's the logo is the brand, then maybe it's not enough. But if you're linked to something in the category that's bigger and you can always remind people of that link, I think that's where creativity is really powerful and where advertising can make people think some kind of concept is related to a brand. And I think if, let's say, you're related to rugby or something, then every yep. time you see rugby, you think about the brand. And I think that's what's really powerful.
Yeah, exactly. And that works with sports. It works with attaching yourselves to songs. It works with attaching yourselves to just interesting cultural moments. It's hacking, right? It's hacking our memories. Yeah. It's doping. It's cheat codes. So,
I'm really happy you brought that up because they are so closely related and that's hugely important.
You did ask about halo effect, so maybe we'll just drop that one in quickly.
Awesome.
And halo effect is really the idea that the first exposure we have to a brand can have a disproportionate effect on how we think of that brand, you know, as a whole. And where we see some interesting examples of this are things like if you wanted to talk to a new insurance company and you jump on their website, and the first thing you do on their website is you go to the search box and you type something into the search box, and the results you get don't really make sense, right? All that really means is that the search function on their website is not very good. That's it, right? But what the halo effect somehow causes us to do is say, well, these guys can't even get the search function on their website right. They're probably not very good at answering my calls, and they're probably not going to be a very good insurance company for me to deal with. So maybe I'm just going to move on, right? So that kind of first interaction we have with a brand is so much more important than we might give it credit for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've just been reading this book. It's called The Halo Effect, and then some other long title. I don't know if you know it.
No, I'm not. It feels like I should read it though.
It's a really interesting book, but it's really about like the whole idea that the halo effect causes us to judge a company's performance, but really badly. For example, let's say a company that's doing really well financially, we automatically think that they have a great company culture and that they have an amazing customer service. And yeah. The problem is that we don't really like can identify what the real drivers of performance are because of the halo effect. And that's like the example you gave. And I think that's important when you're doing strategy, like when you're trying to define what are the powerful drivers behind this brand. Often when one thing is really good, we tend to say that everything's really good. And when like financial is really bad, we tend to say that everything's really bad. So it's a really powerful effect when you're trying to do strategy for a brand.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're really good at doing as humans is, without noticing it, substituting really hard questions for really easy questions. So if you were to ask somebody, like if you'd ask yourself, should I buy shares in Tesla, right? That's a really hard question, because to really objectively answer that question, you need to know what is the market size, what is their current share price and market capitalization, how is that representing the reality? You basically need to understand all of their financial models. Like, to understand if the current share price for Tesla is good or bad, you need to know a lot of stuff that honestly I'm never, ever, ever going to understand. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we tend to do is we tend to go, should I buy shares in Tesla? I like Tesla. Right? Tesla's a good brand. I can get behind that.
Elon is cool.
Elon's cool. I will buy shares in that. You know, same thing with voting for presidents or prime ministers, where you go, is this person going to be a good president or prime minister? Right? It's a really hard, multifaceted, complicated question. And oftentimes what we end up accidentally doing is substituting, should I vote for this person as prime minister or president, with would I like to go out and have a beer with this person? And if the answer to the second question is yes, then we kind of tend to just substitute that for the answer to the first question. So I like this person. They're kind of agreeable to me. Yes, I think they'd make a good president or prime minister. So the halo effect is a big contributor to that.
Absolutely. Like, what's also interesting to me is probably because your podcast is called Bad Decisions, and a lot of times when you're reading this research, it's really about like how we're like biased and how we sometimes make irrational decisions. But I'm wondering, like, does it also contribute to the fact it must have some benefit? Otherwise, like, evolution would have probably phased it out, or we wouldn't survive as a species. Like, does it also help us in a good way?
Yeah. I mean, so the thing is, we make lots of bad decisions about things that usually don't really matter that much. And if we didn't have this whole list of mental shortcuts that we rely on unknowingly every minute of every day of our lives, you and I would still both be, well, I don't know if you are at home, but you know, here it's almost 6 p.m. Melbourne time. Like, I would still be at home trying to work out what I should eat for breakfast, you know, weighing up the calorific intake and outputs and the cost benefits of having cereal versus toast. So we need to have mental shortcuts just to help us get through the day. And the benefit is we get to live, right? We get to go out and do stuff. The downside is that sometimes we make decisions that aren't really very good, but usually they are not too life-threatening in any major way.
Your yogurt choice isn't going to kill you.
Exactly. And so we've just decided that is not worth spending too much time on. And because we've made these shortcuts, they are susceptible to kind of be intercepted and hacked. And somebody says to us, when you are looking for yogurt, look for the one with protein, right? And we don't know whether that's actually a good thing or a bad thing, but that sounds like a good thing to do. So we'll pick that. And if it's right or wrong, we're probably not going to die. But God, at least we can just eat the yogurt and get on with our day.
Awesome. Well, how many heuristics are left for you to like do in the podcast, or did you already have them all?
You know, it's funny. So we've done 25 now, and what we're finding is now it's starting to get a little bit messy because they all sort of, it's still a very new field, right? So people are kind of coining things and naming things all the time. And depending on what list you look at, you can find literally hundreds and hundreds of them. But when you kind of scratch in, it's like, oh, this is basically the other thing, just with a slightly different twist on it. So I think we could go on forever. And we would probably notice the overlaps more than other people would. But I think there's still plenty of runway ahead of us.
Awesome. Well, Dan, this was super interesting. I think listeners will have enjoyed listening to the whole heuristic story because it's interesting. Like, if people want to learn more, what are some resources they can find?
Cool. So you've done a wonderful job of plugging the podcast. So thank you for that. So obviously, Bad Decisions podcast you can have a listen to. I think some of the books that we've mentioned, so Nudge and Predictably Irrational, are both really, really great books on the subject. Also, Rory Sutherland has just brought out a new book called Alchemy, which sort of absolutely plays in this space as well. It's a fantastic read. It's about why ideas that don't actually make sense can often work really, really well. So I'd say they're three really good starting points.
Awesome. Well, people, if people want to find you, Dan, like, how can they reach out?
Internet is good, so you can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Just put my name into the box. You'll find me.
Awesome. Dan, thank you so much for coming out at this, late hour for you.
No problem. So I should just say the other way, if people want to find me, obviously the agency is called Hard Hat. So if they jump on hardhat.com.au, you can get in touch through there as well.
Awesome. See you, Dan.
All right, cool. Thanks a lot. See ya.
Dan, just one more question. If you could send me a picture for the promotional stuff, that'd be great.
Yeah, of course. Sure.
Did you like doing the podcast?
Yeah, that was good. God, I hope I felt like I was rambling in a few places there.
No, absolutely not. I think it was really good. I think we had some nice heuristics and some like the team around it, so I think it was great.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah, I hope you got what you needed.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. And what's the schedule like?
I think it's gonna be 2 or 3 weeks, because I have a couple of episodes in the bucket. So I'm going to publish those first. And then if you just get me a picture and a short bio, I'll have it ready and I'll send you a link once it's up.
Okay, easy.
Awesome.
Cool. Thank you so much. That was fun.
All right, that was it for this episode. As always, I really hope you enjoyed this interview, and I'm looking
really
forward
excited
to...
about this podcast season. I already had some really interesting guests, and it's only gonna get better. So if you have any feedback, if you like the podcast or you don't, it's too long, too short, you want more solo episode,
please shoot me an email at hello@letstalkbranding.be. I'm happy to hear your thoughts. And if you're interested in more news, you can always visit letstalkbranding.be and subscribe to the newsletter. Thanks again. See you next week.